Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Charlotte Gallagher, and in the early hours of Friday, the 16th of June, these are our main stories. 9 people are arrested following the sinking of a migrant ship, which has killed about 80 people, with 600 still missing. The UN Secretary General says the global response to climate change has been pitiful, as northwest India and southern Pakistan are hit by one of the most powerful cyclones there in years. And German police say a woman has died after being assaulted near one of the country's most popular tourist sites. Also in this podcast, robocops take to the streets of Singapore and...
Just like Jaws, they had to try to fend the shark off with paddles. I mean, we've been in touch with a lot of scientists. A scientist was with us. This had never been seen before by the scientists.
A film crew's close encounter with a tiger shark. We begin with a tragedy in the Mediterranean Sea. 9 Egyptians have been arrested on suspicion of people smuggling after a migrant boat disaster off the coast of Greece. Nearly 80 people are known to have died. Hundreds are still missing. And it's feared that as many as 750 people were on board. Survivors have told the BBC that up to 100 children may have been on the ship. This man is looking for his relatives.
My relatives were on the boat that capsized.
How do you know that?
We've had confirmation that we found one of the relatives is in there, but the rest of them we haven't got hold of yet.
How many relatives?
Just 4 of them.
Nick Beek, who we heard there, is at the port of Kalamata, where the survivors are being treated. He filed this report just before we recorded the podcast.
Well, on Thursday night, there have been some protests against the Greek government's handling of this disaster. People taking to the streets to say how angry they are. But the truth is, over the past 2 years, as the Greek government has pursued a tougher policy on migration, that's been broadly welcomed by the Greek public. Clearly, though, there is a human toll, a human cost to these policies. The Greek Coast Guard is maintaining that it offered support to the migrants who are on the boat, and that offer of support was rejected. But lots of people are saying that that simply doesn't cut it, because if you're a Coast Guard out at sea and you see that a vessel has lots of people on board, is badly overburdened and is in such deep waters, there is a moral obligation to step in and to do more. And the allegation is that the Greek authorities, although they say they did what they could, they did not do enough. And that is what critics continue to say. All the while, more families of those who are missing are coming to this port city, desperate for any sort of news. And we are hearing this figure of 750 people having been on board. We know 100 people were rescued, so that leaves the dreadful possibility, the dreadful likelihood that some 650 people lost their lives.
Nick Beek. Now to a warning from the United Nations.
The collective response remains pitiful. We are hurtling towards disaster, eyes wide open, with far too many willing it all on wishful thinking, unproven technologies and silver bullet solutions. It's time to wake up and step up.
At a summit in New York, the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said the goal of keeping global heating to less than 1.5 degrees above pre-industrial levels was still possible if the fight against climate change was accelerated. His warning came as the latest in the ever-accelerating series of major storms, Cyclone Biparjoy, made landfall in northwestern India and southern Pakistan. The cyclone could be the most powerful to hit the area in a quarter of a century. Our correspondent, Arunday Mukherjoy, is in Gujarat on the west coast of India. He spoke to us after visiting a shelter.
The weather officials have officially said, quote unquote, that the landfall process has begun. And we've seen the effects of that on the ground because we are currently at our place of stay indoors, but we can hear the wind, the howling wind outside. And the wind speeds have only picked up in the last couple of hours, and so has the rain. So there's rainfall as well as heavy wind. And the rainfall has been coming in bursts. So you have very intense rainfall for a few minutes and then it kind of dissipates, but the winds then pick up. So it's been a combination of factors, and I think in the next couple of hours overnight it is really going to pick up, because even officials said that once landfall happens, the cyclone effects will remain for the next few hours.
And so many people have had to move for their own safety, and you've been going to shelters and talking to people. What have they been saying to you?
Nearly 70,000 people have been relocated from the shorelines, and this operation has been carried out across the entire shoreline of the western state of Gujarat, and they've been taken to makeshift shelters, which basically are government schools, which are now turned into homes for these people who have been shifted. There's a lot of uncertainty. Even though this area is not new to cyclones, they have witnessed these situations and scenarios play out repeatedly, but this time officials have also said it's the worst cyclone in 25 years to hit this state. In that context, the worries and anxieties are much higher. They've already spent one night last night, and this will be their second night, but the really long night, because this is the night which will decide what happens, and that's what we're waiting for. Because, just like all the others, what they will wake up to is what will determine the next few days.
And is India well prepared for weather events like this?
If you compare it to the last major cyclone that hit the same region in 1998, that left a huge trail of death and destruction. In fact, official figures put the death toll at around 4,000. But the unofficial figure, locals tell us, was close to 10,000. And since then, a lot of analysts have also pointed out that the ability to predict cyclones has improved. The infrastructure has also improved. So in that comparison, there seems to be a little more preparedness. And that's the general sense that we got from people on the ground when we spoke to them as well.
And I think I can actually hear a bit of the wind in the background where you are. And presumably you're battened down already and you can still hear it.
Yes. In fact, we drove out a short while back and, we did get a sense that it was that final lull before the storm. Trees have been swaying, billboards in the area have been rattling. You've got a lot of tin roofs in makeshift houses where a lot of people live as well in the villages. They've been rattling, and there's a real fear of them turning into projectiles and causing a lot of damage.
Arunde Mukherjee. Police in Germany have arrested an American tourist on suspicion of murder after a woman died near Neuschwanstein Castle in Bavaria. Another woman was also injured. Damien McGuinness reports from Berlin.
The two young women were hiking near the Bavarian fairy tale castle Neuschwanstein when they met a 30-year-old American man who offered to show them a secret trail to a beauty spot with a good view of the castle. When they got there, he allegedly assaulted the 21-year-old woman, and when her 22-year-old friend intervened, he allegedly choked her and pushed her down a steep slope. She fell some 50 metres. Police accused the man of then attempting a sexual offence against the younger woman, who was also pushed down the incline. Rescue workers found the two women lying injured together in the ravine. The 21-year-old died later in hospital. Neuschwanstein is one of Germany's most famous and most visited tourist sites. Police are calling on anyone who was visiting the castle at the time to come forward if they have any information about the attack.
Damien McGuinness in Berlin. Ukraine's counteroffensive against Russian forces occupying its territory is in its second week. Kyiv says it's made gains in the Donetsk region in the east and Zaporizhia. Against this backdrop, the Ukrainian defence minister is in Brussels to brief a NATO meeting. There to greet him was the US Defence Secretary Lloyd Austin, who urged nations to keep support to Ukraine flowing.
We remain laser focused on meeting Ukraine's urgent needs for ground-based air defense systems. And that's especially important since Russia has ruthlessly ramped up its missile and drone attacks over the past month against Ukraine cities.
Our defense correspondent, Jonathan Beale, is also in Brussels.
There are two things that are going on today. First of all, there's this commitment that the West has made to train Ukrainian pilots to learn to fly Western jets, which Ukraine has been pressing for. Ukraine's defense minister, welcomed that news when he arrived here in Brussels for this meeting. But of course, at the moment, there is no specific pledge, no timeline to actually provide Ukraine with Western jets. That's ultimately what they want, particularly US-made F-16s. But the focus, and laser focus is the word that Lloyd Austin, the US defense secretary, used, is on helping Ukraine in its offensive at the moment, which is obviously a ground war. We've heard specific pledges from a number of countries to provide more air defence ammunition and systems for Ukraine, and also artillery. And today's announcements for more munitions, and also NATO looking at their whole system of producing ammunition, whether they can streamline that, ramp up production, which they need to do for themselves, as well as to keep on providing Ukraine with ammunition, particularly artillery ammunition. They are still committed to doing that, and they are also using terms like we're in this for the long haul.
And obviously for Ukraine, the ultimate goal, the ultimate dream would be to be a member of NATO. Is that still really pie in the sky?
So I think the words that the head of NATO, Jens Stoltenberg, Secretary General, has used is that we're all agreed, he says, that Ukraine will be a member. I'm not sure that is actually factually true. I think Hungary's president has certainly questioned that, and Hungary has not been supportive of other NATO allies' help for Ukraine. It stayed on the sidelines largely, and clearly there's a relationship between Hungary and President Putin. But I think that, you know, there is a difference. There is a divide within NATO about how far to go to setting out a roadmap for Ukrainian membership of NATO, which will have to be addressed next month at the heads of state meeting of NATO leaders, which will take place in Vilnius. Some countries, notably the ones on the eastern flank of the alliance, would like clear signals for Ukraine's membership. Other countries a little bit more reticent, and I think that includes being cautious about this, Washington and Berlin. Everybody is fully aware that Ukraine cannot be a member of NATO while this war rages on. But there are Eastern European countries that would like to see Ukraine quickly become a member as soon as that war stabilizes, if it does, so that Ukraine has that long-term security guarantee that if it's attacked again by Russia, that NATO will be by its side, the one-for-all principle.
That was Jonathan Beal. Next, I think this is my favourite story in the podcast today because it may sound like something from a dystopian future or a Hollywood film. But Singapore has deployed a fleet of robocops across the city-state after a successful trial run. Our Asia-Pacific editor, Michael Bristow, told me more.
I think the first thing to make clear is that in people's mind, they might be thinking about RoboCop, the science fiction film where you get this aggressive, able law enforcement agent basically willing to stop anything. Actually, it isn't like that at all, and I don't want you to laugh at this, but it looks a lot like a large wheelie bin. Essentially, it's 1.7 metres tall. It's got a camera on the top which can look 360 degrees. It sends information back to a control room where there's a flesh and blood officer sat there monitoring what goes on. And so it's basically observational, but the Singapore police does say it has what it calls interim intervention measures. These are basically flashing lights, speakers, a siren. So if something happens and this robot cop is around, it can alert bystanders to what's going on. It can even act as a kind of cordon to stop people getting near to something until a human police officer arrives.
And I suppose people will get used to them, but it must be a bit of a shock when you see them for the first time and you're thinking, what on earth is this? How have they gone down in Singapore?
They seem to have gone down okay. Actually, they've been in testing in various guises for a couple of years, and this particular robot police operative has been tested for the last couple of months at the main airport in Singapore, going round and checking people out, leaving bags here and there and everywhere, and assisting the normal police in their job. So it seems that the police in Singapore are sensitive to that, and so they've introduced them gradually, and they're going to introduce them across the rest of the city-state in a progressive fashion, they say, so gradually, so people get used to them.
Why robocops? Is it because there aren't enough physical police officers?
That's it, exactly. Singapore's got a labour shortage across every industry, from construction, IT, restaurants, hotels, everything, and the police force is no different. So essentially what the Singapore police force has done is come up with an innovative way of getting over the fact that they haven't got enough real policemen to do the job.
That was Michael Bristow. Still to come in the podcast.
I think that the people who know now that it will change, they will be really disappointed.
The highway to hell that officials want to rename. The president of Venezuela's National Electoral Council has resigned, along with at least seven other members, ahead of next year's elections. It comes after years of accusations from the opposition that the council is biased towards the president, Nicolas Maduro. Our Americas editor, Leonardo Rocha, gave us more details.
The opposition in Venezuela that has been completely split for many years and they've been out of power for decades, they've decided to hold primaries in American style and choose a single candidate from they're all different parties, but they will get together in October and choose a single candidate to challenge President Nicolas Maduro. And they asked the electoral committee to contribute, to oversee the process. But the government has been opposed to that. And what the opposition now is speculating is whether this mass resignation is related to that. If President Maduro will appoint people who are more loyal to him and who will basically block the primaries.
So the implication, would that mean that the presidential election next year would not be fair then?
I think the whole world is going to watch, because especially the United States, because last year things started to change. There was a thaw in relations between Venezuela and the US, a lot of it motivated by the war, the invasion of Ukraine, the US needing new sources of oil, and political talks began. What we understand is that the agreement is you're going to hold free and fair elections next year, presidential elections, and then he could be politically maybe rehabilitated. But this might be seen as a step back.
Because it seemed that there was a gradual sort of warming of relations between Maduro and the United States.
There was last year when it was announced that the U.S. had sent a delegation. But every now and again, you have new, let's say, aggressive declarations. You have now the Iranian leader visiting Venezuela. So you have a new left-wing government in Brazil that seems to be a bit more hostile to the United States. They will see how, by they, I'm talking about the United States and the European Union, they will see how things evolve if the opposition is allowed to run in next year's elections.
That was Leonardo Rocha. Lagos, Nigeria's economic hub, is one of Africa's wealthiest cities and has continued to record rapid growth. But the city's development may be coming at a huge cost. Migration into the city is impacting the residents' quality of life, and poor air quality is leading to illnesses and premature deaths. Azizat Olaoluwa reports.
I guess because it's not something that's tangible. You can't really see how bad it is. You think, oh, it's something that should be disregarded.
Sumbo Olani is an architect living with her family in Surulere, Lagos, one of the most polluted cities in the world, where pollution is between 6 and 10 times the WHO's maximum recommended level.
Getting to know about the effect of air pollution in Lagos State really, really changed my mindset to a lot of things.
According to a 2022 World Bank report, 30,000 people die every year in Lagos because of pollution-related diseases. The open burning of waste, dust, industrial activities, heavy traffic, vehicles with highly polluting engines and generators are the major causes of air pollution. After reading the report, Sumbo and her family responded by making small adjustments in their day-to-day lives.
We've totally reduced how often we turn on our generators. I think in the last month we've only had it on once or twice. Then we've also reduced oil quantity that we consume. We're looking at other clean sources of energy like solar, because it's such a busy state.
Anaji, let's cover up, please, just before we start. Thanks for
But Sumbo has gone one step further by joining a collective of citizen scientists runners who campaign to reduce air pollution in major African cities. At the popular Tejosho Market in central Lagos, the Citizens for Clean Air march with placards that read, "Air pollution is a silent killer. Clean air is a human right. And who they breathe," which means who is breathing good air. Along their route, they use sensors to map air quality across the city's neighborhoods and raise awareness.
Just check behind. you can see plastic and wastage is there. And these things, they might just end up getting being burnt, open burning.
Citizen runner Waziri Mainasara carries his 2-year-old daughter on his shoulders on the city walk. He tells me that he grew concerned about the city's air quality after she was born.
Kids and adults, grown up, the aged people, are more vulnerable to air pollution because their respiratory system are fragile. So as a father, I'm worried.
The Lagos State Environmental Protection Agency, LASEPA, is in charge of safeguarding the environment. Dr. Dolapo Fashawe is its general manager.
Most of the vehicles here in Nigeria are over 15 years old, using old technology. And also, our petrol has a high level of sulfur.
Fashawe says the government has set new targets against air pollution and set up a team to control emissions and educate communities about the danger of cooking with fossil fuel and firewood.
What we're doing now especially is encouraging other modes of transportation, like waterways, mass transit, and I'm happy to tell you that we've just got our first electrical-powered rail line in Lagos.
Citizen campaigners like Sumbo and Waziri say they will continue to campaign for clean air for the sake of future generations.
The Lagos of my dream is a place where people don't have to think before knowing that quality air is actually very important.
So that we could have a better life, we could have a better environment, and then we could live longer.
That report by Azizat Ola Aluwa in Lagos. The biggest group of Protestant churches in the United States, the Southern Baptists, have voted to expel two churches because they have female pastors. The churches were among five that were initially expelled in February, but they'd appealed. I've been speaking to our religion reporter, Harry Farley.
Well, this is a debate that goes back decades, really, across different Christian denominations around what the Bible teaches is the role of women in church. And the conservatives point to passages in the Bible around women not teaching or not having authority over men, maybe not speaking in church. So they point to those passages in the Bible, and then proponents of women being allowed to lead churches and speak in churches say, well, those passages rely, you know, to a particular context in a particular time. And the overall message of the wider Bible is that men and women are equal and that women should be allowed to lead church. So this is really just the latest iteration, as it were, of a decades-long debate across different Christian denominations.
And these two churches that have just been expelled, do we know what they're going to do? Do we know what their plans are?
We don't. They haven't said yet. I mean, the Southern Baptist Convention is a very loose convention of churches. They don't have to be part of any particular convention. They can be independent, so they may just choose to be independent. I think what's particularly significant about these two churches, or one of them in particular, is that Saddleback Church, which is a mega church in California, it was the second largest church in the Southern Baptist Convention. And Rick Warren, its pastor who's recently retired, is very well known across the US. And so it's a particularly big loss for the Southern Baptist Convention, this massive mega church in California, that they're no longer part of their convention.
Is this a wider problem within the whole of Christianity, different parts of the Catholic Church, the Anglican Church, the role of women, gay marriage, for example, and the pressures and the fractures that's causing?
Across the spectrum of different Christian denominations, you've got a wide range of views on women as well as on sexuality. You know, on the most conservative end, the Catholic Church won't allow women to be priests and won't allow women to take communion or to preach in church. And then right on the other end of the spectrum, in say the Episcopal Church in the US, women are allowed to preach and lead communion, and then same-sex couples are allowed to do the same. So there's this whole plethora of different views within the Christian church, within and different types of Christianity across the world. I'd say within evangelicalism, and within white American evangelicals in particular, we have seen over the last decade or so a conservative drift, a trend towards being more hardline on issues like women preaching in church and on issues like sexuality.
Harry Farley. Now, we all know the feeling of having a tough day at the office, but for the film crew behind David Attenborough's latest documentary, they had the ordeal of facing two tiger sharks attacking their inflatable boat off the coast of a Hawaiian island. The series producer of Our Planet 2, Hugh Cordy, told us what happened.
The team were trying to film an animal called the Leysan albatross on Leysan Island, which is a very remote island in Hawaii. And the idea was to film this chick fledging. And when they fledge, tiger sharks travel hundreds of miles to reach these islands at just the time the albatross chicks start to fledge and fly off. And because it's their first flight, often the chicks don't fly very far. They sort of drop in the water just off the beach. And that's what these tiger sharks come for. So they eat these young albatross chicks. And they've got the whole crew in the boat. And the shark makes a beeline for them and just hits the boat very aggressively. And the whole crew are extremely shocked because this isn't the kind of behavior you would expect. In fact, tiger sharks are quite gentle and quite nervous creatures. So the idea that, you know, they would approach us was something that was totally unexpected. And they moved a little bit further on. They saw another shark and they approached it very, very gently. And this shark attacked the boat to the point where it actually came out of the water and tried to board the boat. And this is a 4 to 5 meter tiger shark, and the boat is really not that much bigger than that. So it was one of those sort of cases of needing a bigger boat. Right. And they were trying to, and just like Jaws, they had to try to fend the shark off with paddles. This was just totally unexpected, and it's very difficult to plan for the unexpected. I mean, we've been in touch with a lot of scientists. A scientist was with us. This had never been seen before by the scientists. And the only explanation they could give is that the tiger sharks had made this very large journey of hundreds of miles, and they were so hungry that all they could think of was trying to hit and bite anything that they saw in the water. And a black boat and an albatross chick, they're not the same size, but they were obviously so intent on trying to feed that that's probably the explanation. And I think it was a simple case of mistaken identity.
I love stories about sharks, but that is like my absolute nightmare, being approached by a shark in the water. But luckily, probably not too many in London. Finally, the biblical road to hell is supposed to be paved with good intentions. But there's also a real road which leads to the Polish resort of hell. So this version of hell, which is spelt H-E-L, is served by the bus route 666, the number of the beast in the Bible, and of course a marketing triumph for the town. But it's also attracted fierce opposition from Polish religious conservatives, who say it's spreading Satanism. So under pressure, the bus company has rebranded the route as 669. But what do local people think? My colleague James Menendez has been speaking to Alex, who's a resident of hell.
I'm really surprised by it because I thought it was something that it was generally accepted by the community here, and it was a touristic attraction and that would never change. But I'm really disappointed, to be honest.
A touristic attraction. Do you think the fact that there is a 66 bus to your town hell has attracted many visitors?
It for sure has attracted maybe attention through social media. I think on Instagram, for example, a lot of people post pictures of the word hell because of the connotation with the place hell. And I think that the bus as well, they post pictures and they write about it. So I think, yeah, it has attracted some attention.
Now, the bus company says that it's had to change the number because it's come under pressure from some religious groups. What did people in the town feel about it? Were they bothered?
To be honest, I think the citizens of hell are really progressive, based also on the electorate, if you see. So I don't think the people were bothered ever because of the number. I think maybe it is outsiders. I haven't really heard of anyone being bothered by it. I think that it was really something widely accepted. And I think that the people who know now that it will change, they will be really disappointed.
That was Alex, who's from hell. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter @globalnewspod. This edition was mixed by Gabriel O'Regan and the producer was Iona Hampson. The editor is Karen Martin and I'm Charlotte Gallagher. Until next time, goodbye.